History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme,
I realised that my force was small and to hesitate might induce attack. I immediately opened fire and dispersed the crowd.
The Amritsar Massacre of 1919, one of the great scandals of British colonial rule in India and a turning point in the Indian independence movement. Also,
they managed to send her a postcard which contained a sketch of the key, allowing a copy to be made in Ireland.
De Valera's sensational escape from Lincoln Jail 100 years ago today, its propaganda value and how it affected the power dynamics of Irish nationalism. Plus,
within ourselves, we wanted a break from the old Ireland. And Club Elizabeth is just symptomatic of that break.
Memories of halcyon days, police raids and dancing the night away at a legendary Dublin nightclub, Elizabeth's. And More Than Concrete Blocks, the new book that explores an overlooked part of the capital's architectural history. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. And we begin this evening in India with one of the most notorious episodes in the history of British colonial rule in that country. It took place 100 years ago in the city of Amritsar in the Punjab region, now in northwest India. On the 13th of April 1919, a British officer ordered his troops to fire on an unarmed crowd, killing hundreds of them. It would become known as the Amritsar Massacre or the Jallianwala Bagh Massacre, named for the walled public space where it occurred. I'm joined now in studio by Kate O'Malley, historian and editor with the Royal Irish Academy's Documents on Irish Foreign Policy series. Kate, you're very welcome indeed to the programme. Just tell us about the state of Indian nationalism in 1919. I think something like 1.5 million Indian soldiers had been fighting in the First World War, so would have been slowly returning, presumably, to India at that stage. Was Gandhi, for example, living in India? What was the state? Was the Congress Party in existence?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting setup. So there's kind of a series of contradictions on the ground in India, if you will. So on the one hand, we have, you know, a lot of those loyal returning officers, as you said. You also have some returning immigrants of the Gadarite variety, the Gadar meaning mutiny. These were Sikh radicals who, much like some Irish people during the war, sought the help of Germans in overthrowing British rule in India. They were coming primarily from Canada and America. So you have these returning to the scene as well. Gandhi returns too. And Gandhi at this stage was a social activist, I suppose, is the best way to describe him. He was actively recruiting for the British during the war. And he came back to the scene, was interested in social activism in relation to kind of, you know, mill workers, farmers, you know, unfair treatment on the part of British administration there, but not necessarily active and very much a moderate activist, not necessarily even a moderate nationalist at this stage. And then you have, from the British perspective, you have the announcement of a certain series of reforms, the Montagu-Chelmsford reforms. So you have on the one hand this kind of, this moment of hope, I suppose, on the part of Indian activists. And then, at the very same time, you have the introduction of this very significant Rowlatt Act. Right. And that's when everything kind of comes to this perfect storm, if you will.
We'll come to the Rowlatt Acts in just a minute or two. But you can imagine that Indians would have been expecting that there would be some quid pro quo, some reward for their enormous contribution to the British war effort in World War One.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that. And there's so many Irish parallels when you look at it as well. But India always was kind of one step behind in relation to their requests, if you will. They would have been happier at this earlier stage with kind of more constrained constitutional developments. And then the British reaction to all of these kind of more subtler demands resulted in a backlash. So certain reforms were expected on the return. But then you also have this added complication of radicalism in Bengal as a result of the partition of Bengal in 1905 and instances of kind of acts of terrorism in Bengal too. So you get this sense from a British administrative point of view of things bubbling in the post-war period. And then from a wider British imperial perspective as well, I guess it's really important to look at 1919 or even the spring of 1919 in particular. And you're looking at the War of Independence breaking out here. You're looking at a revolution breaking out in Egypt. And then much more close to home to the Punjab, you're looking at Afghanistan. And another Afghan war is in the offing too, with an anti-British emir there. So there's a wider British imperial kind of geostrategic aspect to it as well.
So describe the increase in tension in the Punjab in 1919.
So what happens is you have the introduction of the Rowlatt Acts. This is really the extension of wartime legislation, if you will, primarily to account for...
Along the lines of what? The Defence of the Realm Act?
Yeah, yeah. There was a Defence of India Act on in wartime, so it would have allowed for...
Which gives the state enormous powers.
Sure, control of the press, arrest without trial, detention without trial. And like you said, when you look at this contradiction, when you have on the one hand constitutional reforms being announced, and then with the other, this, you can understand why this is, especially political activists would have been very confused and quite irritated. But you have then Gandhi who comes back with this new form of non-violence activism from South Africa, the Satyagraha, which means soul force, which is passive. It is non-violent. And what he calls for in reaction to the Rowlatt Act is a one day of, we would use the term strike or lockout, I suppose, but one day of fasting and prayer, very much passive, non-violent protest against the introduction of the Rowlatt Act. So this is called Hartal. And this came this call happened in March. And it was, you think of the vastness of India then and indeed now. The way in which this was answered was, mixed. On the one hand, there was relatively successful strikes in Delhi, but it was very hard for Gandhi or indeed any of the other nationalist elite at this time to kind of keep control of this type of a movement when you have a kind of a growing momentum. So there is a result. As a result of some of these strikes, you get kind of, riots, looting and the likes of that. But in Punjab in particular, tensions are really high because Punjab is also, again, another contradiction, a recruiting ground for the British Indian Army. And then you have a lot of these returning Gadar Sikhs as well. So Punjab, the British are very concerned about this bubbling, getting the better of them.
And at the back of their minds, obviously, was 1857,
sure.
The Indian Mutiny. Obviously,
yeah.
It was not within immediate memory, but it certainly would have been in collective memory and in folk memory, and it would have been uppermost in the minds of British colonial administrators, I presume.
Absolutely, Miles. And in particular, Dyer himself, because Dyer was raised...
Now, tell me about Dyer. This is Brigadier General Reginald Dyer.
Yeah, Reginald Dyer, British general in the Indian Army, who was... a family were in India for many generations, in fact. So even though he was, for part of his time, schooled here, actually in Cork. He was British Indian, and he would have had, very astute awareness of British history in India, and would have been infused with this memory of the 1857 First Indian War of Independence, as it's called, as well as the mutiny, and would have been raised, it has to be said, with in this kind of backdrop of racial hatred towards some of the radical Indian activists, and definitely ignorance of the growing Indian nationalist movement. So he really was at this particular time, I suppose, paranoid about the potential of another revolt of that on that scale. And lots of historians would argue that it's this kind of fear and paranoia that resulted in the actions. But it has to be said, you can't really look at his actions in Amritsar without viewing them through a racist prism.
And what about that old great British tradition of divide and rule? Why wasn't that working for them in the Punjab? Setting the Hindus and the Muslims at each other's throats?
Well, I suppose you've got the complicating factor of the Sikh community there too. It wasn't that straightforward. And one of the things that irked Dyer and O'Dwyer, who we might talk about in a little while as well, is the fact that there appear to be on the ground this sense of actual working together on the part of the three religious communities there. And this was something that really struck fear in their minds, because this hadn't necessarily happened before, at least they weren't faced with it before.
Okay, let's get on to the actual events of the day in question and the Amritsar massacre. So Dyer is in Amritsar. There is a demonstration, a festival. Mm. No one quite knows exactly what it was or what it was supposed to be. Describe what, from his point of view, what he encountered.
So in the wake of Gandhi's call for Hartal or a strike, there had been some looting and arson in the days in the lead up to April 13th in the area, and five Europeans were killed, and quite famously as well, although she wasn't killed, she was severely injured. An English missionary school teacher called Miss Shepherd had been attacked, and lots of people as well say that this was at the forefront of Dyer's mind, although I don't think it was. The famous crawling law was then brought into place, where any native quote unquote person passing the house that she was attacked in had to crawl on their hands and feet, and so you get this sense that, you know, Dyer is coming to the scene where Europeans have been attacked, everybody was under threat in the civil lines, and he was he had as well, it must be said, although it wasn't distributed effectively, said that gatherings now, there would be a curfew, and political gatherings of any kind were banned. And so when he heard about this gathering in Jallianwala Bagh of up to 20,000 people, he thought this was, you know, something that had to be tackled. So himself and 50 soldiers went down to this enclosed square with repression in mind, it has to be said.
Let's hear his own words. This is how Brigadier General Reginald Dyer described the incident in his report on their return to base.
I entered the park by a very narrow lane, which necessitated my leaving my armoured cars behind. On entering, I saw a dense crowd estimated at about 5,000. A man on a raised platform addressing the audience and making gesticulations with his hands. I realised that my force was small and to hesitate might induce attack. I immediately opened fire and dispersed the crowd. I estimate that between 200 and 300 of the crowd were killed. My party fired 1,650 rounds. I returned to my headquarters about 1,800 hours.
And those are the words of Brigadier General Reginald Dyer. You've actually been in this square where the massacre took place. Describe it to me.
The laneway, it's incredibly claustrophobic. I guess the best way to describe it would be if you think of, you know, maybe Stephen's Green or Merrion Square, but on a much larger scale, and it's kind of hemmed in by really large houses, and the only way up is this enclosed laneway with very tall walls either side that maybe you would fit two to three people abreast walking up there. So it was kind of a shocking experience to go there, knowing what had happened. I believe it's been changed and it's gotten a facelift since I was there a long time ago now in 2005, but the physicality of the location, it makes you wonder about the violence that was unleashed there, and how he couldn't have but known there was nowhere to go. There was nowhere for the crowds to disperse, but also, having said that, they weren't told to disperse. They were not given any warning, and it was quite clear that they were unarmed, that they were peaceful, both protesters and people who had come from the surrounding areas. There was Baisakhi, which is a Sikh festival, a harvest festival going on there. So lots of these people would have never even thought that there was a, you know, coinciding political hurtle going on or
little,
otherwise.
A little bit reminiscent of a massacre closer to home 100 years beforehand, the Peterloo massacre.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now,
yeah.
Dyer is one person. There's an O'Dwyer, and the two are often mixed up. Michael O'Dwyer. Yeah. Tell me about Michael O'Dwyer.
So Michael O'Dwyer was the Governor General of the Punjab, and he was an Irishman. He was a Catholic from County Tipperary, one of 14, but he came from a landowning family. And although, I mean, there's accounts of O'Dwyer, in his earlier time in India, being looked upon favourably by local people because of his attitudes towards land reform and whatnot, in contrast to this, there's also the sense that his Irishness made him, you know, all the more fierce in his loyalty towards the Crown and towards British India. And he, in particular, is quite unique in the sense that he initially supported Dyer and said that his action was, quote-unquote, correct. But he didn't backtrack on this when the facts became apparent, and when the violence and the atrociousness of what happened became apparent to him, he still, you know, supported his man, if you
will. What happened to Dyer?
So Dyer ultimately lost his job, but he didn't get any kind of form of punishment, if you will. And also, interestingly, he gained quite a lot of support back in Britain, where, you know, there was a lot of fundraising for his retirement and his case. I think the Morning Post had something like subscription called The Defender of the Empire, and he got something like £26,000, an awful lot at that time, raised for his pension plan, if you will, quite unusual. So on the one hand as well, reaction to Dyer and to Jallianwala Bay from a British perspective is interesting, because you have figures like Churchill, who quite famously is quoted as having said that the episode was without precedent, and it was an extraordinary event. It was it was sinister and singular, and nothing like that had happened in the history of British imperialism, right? But then when you go on to see what Churchill does later on in his career in relation to India and the famine in particular in the Second World War, this is something that is quite contradictory.
That Churchill quote re-emerged a few years back.
Yeah, it did indeed. I think David Cameron used it when he visited Amritsar in a visitor book. I could be wrong there, but I'm almost sure that's what happened, which I think is slightly insensitive on his part. But I think the risk of using this quote in particular of Churchill is that what has happened since in British imperial historiography and more generally is that when you look at it as this, you know, horrific, this monstrous, singular event, what you're really doing is, excuse the pun, you're whitewashing it. Mm. You know, so it hasn't really been addressed as adequately up until relatively recently by historians of British imperial history than it should have been, at least I think so.
In relation to O'Dwyer, somebody was waiting in the long grass for him.
Indeed, and this is you know, an example of what goes around comes around. O'Dwyer then retires. He is in 1940 visiting Caxton Hall, where I think there was a meeting of the East India Association or something to that effect in his retirement. He was 75 years of age, going about his business. And Udham Singh was an Indian Sikh, by then radical, who had been in Jallianwala Bay that day and had been injured, and he shot him and killed him. So this is how Michael O'Dwyer died. And I think it's interesting when you look at Gandhi in particular, who said of Dyer, just to kind of give you an idea of his sense of what happened in Amritsar, he said that we do not want to punish Dyer. We have no desire for revenge. We want to change the system that produced Dyer. Mm. And I think that's what we take from this, that although people would say that, you know, he was filled with this sense of paranoia and fear, really the British colonial system created Dyer, and he was a product of it.
Was it a pivotal moment in the way that Easter Week in Dublin in 1916 was pivotal?
Absolutely. I mean, for many moderate nationalists, it was a turning point. Again, lots of 1916 parallels when you look at what happened in the wake of the executions here. Gandhi was no longer a moderate nationalist. Many more thousands were no longer moderate nationalists. And the non-cooperation campaign that happened in the 1920s quite simply wouldn't have happened if Amritsar hadn't.
Kate O'Malley, thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening to talk about the Amritsar massacre of 100 years ago. After the break, we'll be staying in 1919 as we look back at a famous prison break which took place 100 years ago today.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 151551 for your texts. And a texter says, what distinguished Gandhi from other leaders in 1919 was that he was a national figure rather than a local power broker. His work advocating for Indian migrants in South Africa made him a champion to Indians across geographical, caste, linguistic and religious lines. Well, today, the 3rd of February marks the 100th anniversary of one of the most famous and significant prison breaks in Irish history. It was on that day, in 1919, that three prominent Irish nationalists, Éamon de Valera, Sean Milroy and Sean McGarry, escaped from Lincoln Jail in England. They had been in prison for their part in the alleged German plot conspiracy against the British, which was, of course, just a pretense to put away troublesome Republican leaders. We're going to hear first from Ian McGarry, longtime director and producer for RTE Television, and also a nephew of one of the escapees, Sean McGarry.
My uncle, Sean McGarry, was one of the three who escaped from Lincoln Jail on the 3rd of February 1919. He was born in 1886, a few years before my father Harry, so I was something of a late arrival. The family was from Dundrum. Sean was involved in the 1916 rising and was sent to Frongoch internment camp in Wales, but was eventually released. He was a longtime senior member of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and he served as its president from May 1917 until November 1918, when he was one of a number of nationalist leaders arrested as part of the so-called German plot and sent to Lincoln Jail. My uncle Sean McGarry's wife, my aunt, played an important role in the escape. there's various versions of this story. They managed to send her a postcard which contained a sketch of the key, allowing a copy to be made in Ireland. It was also her who baked a cake with a key inside that was sent to the prisoners. I first learned about my family connection to the escape as a teenager when my own father mentioned it very briefly in passing. He never went into great detail, as he didn't like to discuss anything to do with the war.
Right, that was our very own Ian McGarry there. I have to say, I know Ian very well. I had no idea that he was related to Sean McGarry. Total revelation to me. I hope Ian is doing well. Recalling the role there that his family played in the escape from Lincoln Jail on the 3rd of February 1919. To talk some more about this, I'm joined in studio by Micheál O'Devlin, historian and publisher of the Kilmainham Tales series of books. Micheál, you're very, very welcome indeed.
Thank you.
Take us back to the reason why these three were in jail in the first place, the German plot, the so-called German plot of 1918.
Well, it's the so-called German plot. Basically, they were linked to a plot with the Germans to join with them to help to overthrow Britain. That was the so-called story. If this document had come out of Dublin Castle, had been perhaps sexed up a little bit by the Republicans, but the British used it as an excuse to arrest all of the leaders, or most of the leaders. But what they actually arrested were the doves rather than the hawks. People like De Valera, who would have been more inclined towards a political settlement, if at all possible, leaving out the much more radical people like Collins, who were quite prepared to use physical force.
But Harry Boland as well.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Harry Boland, hugely important.
And this is one of the reasons why so many of the members of the First Dáil were not present, that they were Féglosa Gáilimh on the 21st of January,
yes, or
1919. Or on the run, exactly, yeah. Now, the planning was quite complicated. It's full of, it's full of cinematic tropes.
Yeah.
And the key in the cake is obviously of major importance. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about the operation. Who planned the operation to begin with?
It originated within the jail. They wanted to get out. It is alleged that De Valera wanted to escape before he was released for his own political reasons and for propaganda purposes. So the prisoners decided that they would organise an escape, and they reached out. But of course, on the outside, there was an escape being planned as well. So the two matched very, very closely together. The problem was, like a lot of these things, communication. And I mean, this story, it's such an incredible one with all of the, as you say, all of the classics of a good escape story there. They send out coded messages, which are not at first understood, takes time to understand them. Replies are sent in, there's communication, cross-communication, missed communication indeed, on one occasion. The very first communication was a postcard, a Christmas card with a cartoon on it. I'm actually looking at a copy of it here.
Apparently completely innocent.
Totally innocent. You look at this, it's a rather badly drawn cartoon of a drunken Sean McGarry outside his house trying to get in. And he says it looks like the keyhole is shrunk. And his key is there, and it's a ginormous key. And the smaller illustration beside it of him sitting in a prison cell, it says Christmas 1918, can't get out. And he's looking at this giant keyhole. But what they actually are is a perfect drawing of the key and of the keyhole that he needed to use it.
But nobody got it originally.
There are a couple of reasons for this. So one is the astonishing fact that one key opened every lock in Lincoln Jail, including the outer doors. So hard to realise that you're being sent out the key to the jail, basically. One of the problems with this, of course, was that the operation of a key was simple. All the prison guards during the day, when they're locking a cell or locking a gate, would simply turn the key once. But at night, under lockdown, they turned it twice. And this put extra pressure on any key going in. But it had to, so, and it had to fit obviously various different keyholes, so you needed a specific size key. And this was what they were trying to indicate when they sent this out. It was sent to Father Kavanagh, who passed it on eventually to Mr. McGarry, but then it went on eventually to Collins, who, as I said, he was the one who finally twigged there was something in it. It wasn't just an innocent Christmas card. Realised what it was, and they got a key made to the specifications.
Did it work?
Well, the key had been made. The original drawing was made from a wax casting that Eamon de Valera had made of the prison keys. He used to serve mass in the prison, and the chaplain was pretty careless about his keys, really, just leaving them on a table in the sacristy.
And his candle wax, obviously, as well.
Yes. So he stole the butts of candles, melted them down into a cigarette box, cut a notch in it to allow the key to go in, and when he got a chance, he used to carry it next to his chest to keep it soft, stuck the key into it, took a perfect mould of it, and went away. He then traced it, gave it to, he was copied then onto the card and sent off to, eventually to Ireland, reaching Collins, and they made a key to match that. The problem was, as De Valera reckoned later, was that when the wax cooled, it shrank. So the key was slightly too small.
Right.
While perfect, it was small. So when they put it in the lock, they tested it, and it snapped. Now, they had a problem getting it out again. Of course, they couldn't leave it there, but they did get out a piece of wire. So they sent a second cartoon, this time a much more Celtic design with the key hidden inside that.
Sorry, I mean, this is absolutely hilarious.
Oh,
the authorities
know.
Didn't get it.
Yeah. I mean, if you wrote this down, nobody would
believe you. No, absolutely not.
Nobody would believe you. But it happened.
Is it any wonder we won the Anglo?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the first key, when you think about it, the first key was brought in, it was baked by Mr. McGarry, as we've heard. Fintan Murphy brought it in to the jail. And he just went up, knocked on the wicket gate, asked for a warder, and said, look, I'm a commercial traveller. Somebody gave me this to give in. And he wouldn't take it. He called down the head warder. He came out, stuck a knife into the key, into a couple of spots, and took it in, and it went in. That's how the first key got in. So you think, OK, they'll be wise to this one. But the second key, they made two keys, basically, on the second one. Liam McMahon's housekeeper, Mrs. Sullivan, is alleged to have made this one. But Frank Kelly took this in.
Now, who was Frank Kelly?
Frank Kelly, he just came in, he knocked on the door. He said exactly the same thing as the first time. And
nobody thought this was unusual, or this was odd, bizarre, or strange.
From strangers.
Cakes arriving at a jail.
Well, there were a couple of things, of course. I mean, you had rationing in England at this time, still post-war. Yet the prisoners were allowed parcels from Ireland.
Mm.
So they were actually being fed, allegedly, better than the prison guards. they were also smuggling in alcohol. Which is an important part of the story.
We'll come to that because we have, you mentioned Frank Kelly. Frank Kelly was working in the Sinn Féin office in Dublin. We have Frank Kelly from the RTE archives sent over to England to assist with the escape. And here he describes how the complex operation came about.
A postcard was received. It was drawn by Sean Milroy and showed two pictures. On the left-hand side was a picture of Sean McGarry, drunk, hat on the back of his head, trying to get his latchkey to fit the door of his house. On the other side was Sean McGarry sitting in a cell very despondently, and the caption was, Sean McGarry can't get out. This was sent to the family and was shown around as a good joke, and it wasn't until Collins saw it that he recognised that there might be something in it, because the key was a full-sized key, although Sean McGarry was only a little man, and he thought that it was possibly a drawing of the key of a cell, which it was. There were several keys. That one went in and was a fader. In the end, blanks were sent in, blank keys, and files were sent in a cake. And a key was made by De Lockery of Kilkenny. He made a master key that opened all locks in the jail.
That's Peter Delacroix of Kilkenny. That was the voice of Frank Kelly there from the RTE archives. Now, famously, the key worked and they were able to get out of their cells, etc., etc. But obviously they then had the problem of the three of them getting out of the jail itself. Yeah. And famously, De Valera, in order to effect his escape, was dressed as a woman. And this is where the story for me gets even more bizarre, because De Valera was what? He was 6'1", 6'2",
somewhere around
there. There or thereabouts. He was a tall man. How in the name of God was a 6 foot tall, 6 foot plus man able to convince prison warders that he was a woman?
He didn't. They walked out very carefully, locking all the gates behind them as they went. They got out of the yard. The exit, the wicket gate, the gate they were coming out was at the back of the jail, and they came out to that. They got out in darkness. They had specifically chosen the night when there would be little or no moonlight for this. This was important to them. And they got out to the gate. And the problem was that Harry Boland and Michael Collins were outside. They had had to signal to them. And again, it's where all of this goes bizarre. They'd had to signal with a flashlight. The flashlight came on but wouldn't turn off, so it wasn't a flash. And Harry Boland had to stuff it into his pocket and try to turn it off in there. Anyway, they got out. Collins, in a little bit impatient, tried a second key that he had in the outer door. There were two doors. And his key broke.
Okay. So they've now got that key is now stuck in the lock.
And they shout to Dev that the key is stuck in the door. So Dev, they have the choice, go back or go on. So Dev decides to go on. He opens the inner door and then decides to try his key in the outer door. And as luck would have it, it pushed the broken piece out.
Okay.
And he gets out. Now, at this stage, he's still dressed as a man, believe it or not. I think where the dress as a woman story comes from is when they get out, they're walking down. They have to walk down to get a taxi. And they come past some soldiers who are back from the war recuperating, and the soldiers are there with their girlfriends. And they reckon they're not going to get past them. So Harry Boland was dressed in a fur coat with a big ruff on it and coat, etc. And he took it off. And he put it on to Dev.
Right.
Now, on Harry, it would have been a long coat. On Dev, of course, a shorter. But Harry was, what, about 5'8"? He was a hell of a lot smaller. And he linked Dev and leaned into him as if they were a couple.
Right.
And this is what they walked past.
This is the myth, if you like.
It is. I think it's a myth propagated by the film, unfortunately.
Now, interestingly, Collins, Collins happy to spring Dev from Lincoln Jail. It's incredibly embarrassing for the British authorities. Yes. But he doesn't want Dev back in Ireland. He wants him out of the country.
I would think, yes. Dev served his purpose. Harry was, Michael Collins was very happy to have Dev in jail as a martyr and to defer to. Now, bear in mind, of course, they were best friends. Mm. You know, they really were good friends at this time. But he was quite happy to have him in prison as a martyr while he propagated a war outside. However, with Dev back, Dev was obviously going to try and change things around to his way again. Yes, some 6 months later, Dev goes off to the States, where he spends his time fundraising, speaking, trying to get support, etc., out there.
Falls out with John Devoy and Daniel Coughlin and Friends of Irish
Freedom. And goes with Boland as well, the love interest, the conflicting love interest. But he goes out, and yes, he has problems out there. And eventually, he decides he wants to come back, and Collins keeps saying, not yet, not yet.
raise more money.
Yes, please do. Stay out of my way. I'm running a very successful war here.
Okay. It's an amazing story. Yeah, it's a bizarre and incredible story, but it's a true story. Michael, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed, Micheál O'Devlin, for joining us. And Micheál, as I mentioned, is the publisher of the Kilmainham Tales series of books, and you can learn more at the website kilmainhamtales.ie. Time now for another instalment in our occasional series, Here's the Thing, where Julian Clancy uncovers the stories behind objects on display in the Little Museum of Dublin. Tonight, he's looking at a vintage poster for a fondly remembered Dublin nightclub.
Jim Fitzpatrick is an artist and activist whose work can be seen in the Little Museum of Dublin. You might recognise his iconic graphic of Che Guevara from 1961, or his album artwork for Thin Lizzy from the 70s. But up there on the wall, there's also a striking silver poster from a legendary Dublin nightclub that's long since disappeared. It was called Elizabeth's.
Elizabeth was just a part of my life at the time. That Friday nights, myself and my ex-wife ended up in Elizabeth's, and we had the best time you could imagine, you know. Swinging was the word. Swinging.
Now, while today Leeson Street is full of late nightclubs and drinking spots, Elizabeth's was the very first.
Because it was so different, and because we were children of the 60s, children of the revolution as we thought, it seemed pretty radical.
Elizabeth's was owned and run by Morris Boland, who named the club after his business partner, one of Ireland's most iconic fashion models at the time, Liz Holaby.
She was on the Late Late Show, that's how famous she was, and she's a fabulous, unassuming person.
In 1969, Jim was a full-on hippie, mad into his music, long flowing hair, and butterflies sewn into his jeans. But he was also an art director for an advertising agency. Jim was asked to create something wild for the inside of Elizabeth's. And so he let his imagination run riot.
By the time they got me involved, I was looking at a basement, and we gutted it, and Alan Willoughby built a whole thing with chicken wire and plaster, magnificent kind of moving, flowing kind of environment. And so it was built like a womb. It was exciting for its time. It was wild for Dublin, you know.
At the back of the club was a huge mural of Liz Holaby's beautiful face in black outline set against a dreamy circle. It was that same image that Jim used to create the poster for Elizabeth's. But today, only a few of them still exist.
The Club Elizabeth poster is essentially Liz Willoughby's face. But the problem was people nicked them left, right and centre, you know what I mean? Because the actual poster was silver foil, which was kind of radical. Nobody had seen that before.
Oh, yeah.
There was no bands or live music in Elizabeth's. Instead, a partially hidden DJ played records from the booth while the crowds danced on the tiny dance floor. Apart from the unique style and look, Elizabeth's also had something else that no other club in Ireland had at the time, a wine licence. Morris, the owner, discovered that if you served food, even late at night, you were also allowed to sell wine. Wine wasn't as popular as it is today, so it was a bit of an acquired taste.
It was like drinking methylated spirits. Honest to God, it was that bad.
But despite this, the place was usually packed. Late-night sessions attracted the attention of the local Gardaí, and over the years, Elizabeth's was raided so often that they installed a light inside the nightclub to warn customers whenever the guards showed up outside.
They had this thing that they'd hold the guards off long enough for Morris even would come out, and everybody would get up, and we all shoved the glasses in the kitchen or under the counter or something like that, and we'd be sitting there with glasses of water like idiots, you know? Because it was after hours drinking, and that was illegal, but God almighty, none of us wanted to go home at 12 o'clock, you know?
Elizabeth's happened during an interesting time in Dublin. Sean Lamas had opened up the country's economy. Young people were beginning to stay in Dublin as opposed to emigrating. And you had places like the Dandelion Market opening up the city centre for young creative people. And it felt like the rest of Ireland was on the cusp of something big.
But in ourselves, we wanted a break from the old Ireland. And Club Elizabeth is just symptomatic of that break. I mean, Nell McCafferty was a regular there, people like that. And June Levine certainly was, you know, Rosita Sweetman. These were all the founders of the feminist movement in Ireland, you know.
But then the troubles happened.
Now, you have to remember all this came to a crashing end in 1973 after the Dublin bombs of 72. Now, there were plenty of nightclubs. Javagos, where the gang goes, and the place out in Stillorgan, Flamingos. But they were big general nightclubs, not intimate small little places. It was not safe.
Jim stopped going to Elizabeth's following the bombings. Eventually, the hippies were replaced by a new generation of nightclub goers. Auctioneers and property tycoons mixing with the likes of politicians like Senator Ted Kennedy or even the Taoiseach, Charles Haughey. But for Jim Fitzpatrick, it was those early years, the more innocent ones at the club, that defined Elizabeth's for him.
It was innovative and it was exciting and inspiring. You met fellow thinkers, souls like yourself. mostly people who just wanted to have a bit of fun. That's all. It wasn't a big political event. But it was all people of a like mind, all rejecting these antiquated teachings that we were being lumbered with.
Elizabeth's closed in 1978, but it sparked an explosion of nightclubs on Leeson Street that's still being felt today. Today, Jim's silverfoil poster of Elizabeth's hangs proudly in the Little Museum of Dublin. They represent a very special time for their creator, Jim Fitzpatrick.
Well, I look back at that time, my life was one of the best times of a life anybody could ever have, you know? It was fun.
And Julian Clancy was reporting there. He was speaking to artist and activist Jim Fitzpatrick about his memories of the much-loved Dublin night spot Club Elizabeth on Leeson Street. Here's the Thing is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. After the break, we'll be staying in the capital as we open up the latest volume in the series of books More Than Concrete Blocks, exploring Dublin's architectural history.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 151551 for your texts. And the story of buildings in Dublin City reveals our capital as a layered and complex place and provides an important perspective on Dublin's political, social, cultural and economic histories. More Than Concrete Blocks is a series of richly illustrated books from Forecourt's Press, and the latest edition, Volume 2, covers the period 1940 to 1972. And the series is edited by architectural historian Ellen Rowley, who joins me now. Ellen, welcome back to the History Show. Thank you very much for joining us. 1940s and 1950s. You know, I don't know much about architecture, but if you were to ask me, I would say, nothing. There's absolutely nothing of any value which materialised in Ireland during that period. I'm sure I'd be wrong, though.
Yeah, well, we would say you are wrong, and it's certainly those are the decades that we were seeking to rescue. We'd always inherited the idea, the history that these were lost decades, and then we were looking at what was happening in terms of what was being written in architectural journals, who was being invited to speak in Ireland, and eventually what was getting built. And this was a period of great expansion in terms of social infrastructure. So this was a time when there's a lot of vocational schools being built and buildings for transport. And it's the start of the Free State is coming to conclusion at the end of the 40s. That dream is still vaguely alive at the end of the emergency period and then the New Republic. So all of these political waves, if you like, are inspiring different building programs.
And you have lots of photographs. The book, by the way, I have to say, is a fantastic production. And I was surprised when you told me that it was priced at only €20. It's a very, very heavy book, and it's incredibly well illustrated. Just a couple of the standout buildings, though, not necessarily from the 40s and 50s, but perhaps from a little bit later in the period that you're covering, 40 to 72. Front page of the book, a very obvious photograph of Liberty Hall rising up.
We have a friend of mine, her dad, Mick Foran, who's photographed. He's about 13 or 14.
Yeah, there's a young lad in the front of it.
Yeah, he's a young fella. He's a cheeky looking young fella who's been photographed by his pal as the Crystal Tower is rising, that is Liberty Hall. And it is finished in 64, so that's just before that, in 1963. And it at the time was the tallest building in Ireland, and it was shortly replaced by Cork County Hall by Patrick McSweeney. But it was designed by Desiree O'Kelly, who was an architect, well, an engineer, then later an architect, who had cut his teeth designing TB sanatoria under Norman White in the Department of Health in the Custom House. And he got the gig for the trade union and went bold, inspired by Frank Lloyd Wright, as were many of the architects through the 30s, 40s and 50s in Ireland, some of whom actually went to study and work with Frank Lloyd Wright. One of the heroes of the book, jumping away from Liberty Hall, is Andy Devan. And he went and studied in the late 40s with Frank Lloyd Wright and returned in 48.
Great quote from Frank Lloyd Wright, quoted in the Irish Times yesterday, that surgeons can bury their failures. Architects advise their clients to grow ivy.
Or cover them in mosaic, perhaps.
That too. Busaras is, I suppose, on one, anybody who's been in Busaras, certainly I would have been there quite frequently for various reasons in the 1970s, gone back to school and therefore don't have great associations with it, but that's completely irrelevant to the architecture of Busaras. It is actually, we have to accept now, a very fine building.
Yeah, but I mean, your point there, Miles, about your associations of returning to school, like architecture is that really curious thing whereby it comes out of economics and social mores and political imperatives, if you like, but it's really deeply linked to the psychology of self. So much of what happens with Busaras is to like or not to like is around it's the psychology, our feeling in it and also outside of it. It's completely marooned. It's an island building. What later on Sam Stevenson builds, highway buildings, this is like an early version of that. So it's deliberately to be circled by traffic because it's considered to be brave new world. This is the era of the bus and the coach. And at the time when it was finished in 1953, it was hailed as the first completed office building in Europe after the first Second World War, and visited by America, British and French study tours of architects, and so it was immediately recognised as a serious piece of architecture.
But by certain people it was a carbuncle before it was even built. The Irish Times, for example, I think got in trouble before it was built.
Yes.
They published an artist's impression. Tell me about that.
And so Michael Scott was raging. They decided to show it as outlandishly huge, oversailing the Custom House, which is, you know, very beloved. Anything by Gandon, of course, is. And so he took the Irish Times, Scott took the Irish Times to court and won. He said it belittled his reputation.
Archer's Garage on Fenian Street. Now that it actually dates back to the 1940s, and in fact, I think you've established that perhaps it's earlier. That's Hendron's Garage I'm thinking of. But Archer's Garage in Fenian Street, very interesting history, because it was illegally demolished, mm-hmm. and I think everybody was shocked mm-hmm. about the fact that the person who demolished it was forced to rebuild it.
Yeah, which is really unusual that somebody is held to account for once. And so that was demolished in a June bank holiday of 1999, which is, you know, supposedly, you know, a very quiet time. But due to public outcry and the activism of Frank MacDonald and then this incredible work by Shane O'Toole as part of our research team, whereby he uncovered the original drawings and mostly the engineering drawings of garlands. And as a result of that, the facsimile, a near complete copy.
Beautiful Art Deco
built.
Building.
Yeah, it's an important building because, as well, again, you can move inside the idea of the single turn of a steering wheel. So this is all the age of the automobile, the ascendancy of the automobile.
The photograph in the book is interesting because it does look very, very pristine. So it's the updated version of the post-1999
and
version.
So importantly, the materials are 2000 materials rather than 1940s concrete.
One of the best examples of modernism, a place I've been many occasions, the interior I described to you has been extraordinarily brutalist, and that's the Berkeley Library in Trinity College. It's a beautiful building from the outside.
Mm.
Not so beautiful from the inside.
I wonder if this is your psychology again coming to play and the pressure of studying. But the Berkeley Library is considered to be Ireland's best late 20th century building and one of the finest post-war libraries in the world, actually, not just Europe. I'd argue that inside, it's completely irrational. It's really hard to work with. You cannot adapt it. You cannot add technologies to it because it's raw, exposed concrete, but it is a piece of, will you go again, I'll bring you, it's a piece of concrete sculpture and it's all been poured on site, so the marks of the pour, the seams, the joinery, that's the wood, the formwork in which the concrete is poured is exposed, and so we have things on the second floor which are light wells that they then transform into desks, that transform into cubbyholes and ramps and whatnot. So it's very much a piece of irrational, brutalist architecture, and it's truly made by hand.
Talking about irrational and brutal, what about the building that we're sitting in at the moment?
Yeah, the RTE radio building, you mean? Yeah, so we do look at RTE campus, and we kind of take a campus overview, so we don't poke around in the interiors in our case study. But this building is...
Because it's an iceberg. Most of it is actually under the ground.
This one is, importantly, most of its function is submerged in the basement, because you needed, you don't need views, you know, you need these particular rooms that are chambers. But it's a copy of, or it's a reference to Mies van der Rohe's Crown Hall in the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. And it's a reinforced concrete building, but we would the architectural community would once again hail this as a pretty great building.
Very interesting book. I mean, going through it, I'm looking at some of the buildings and thinking, oh my God, who in God, not even their own mother would think that they were beautiful, but they're in the book, and you know, maybe 40, 50 years
from
now.
But it isn't beauty. I think this is all about raising awareness,
right.
And it's more saying, like, beauty is such a subjective category. Who knows what the next generation will think is beautiful. But really importantly, we are recognising that a generation of buildings have been so badly maintained or demolished that they're disappearing. So it's about raising awareness, really simply, and not being too snobbish about it.
Okay, the book is More Than Concrete Blocks, Dublin's 20th Century Buildings and Their Stories. Volume 2 covers 1940 to 1972, published by, or distributed rather, by Four Courts Press. Ellen Rowley is the editor. Thanks very much for joining us on The History Show. That's all we've got time for this evening. Details of all items and podcasts available on our website. My thanks to Kieran Dunn on sound tonight and our researcher Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.